Thanks very much, Nianadhari. And thanks very much to the Dublin chapter for inviting me to give this talk. So, privileged to talk to all of you. So, this morning I'm talking about karma and rebirth. And it's a topic that's been on my mind, as you may well know, over the last few months. I've written two articles about it, one in the November 2013 chapter and one in the latest February chapter. And I've been reflecting on it from different points of view, and we'll take some of what I've been saying in the articles this morning, but I'll also go into one or two different areas. Back in the early days of Tri Ratna, we used to listen to a lot of Sangharakshita's lectures, take lectures. And as far as I remember, the one which was the longest in the entire catalogue of his recorded talks in the West was the one on karma and rebirth. I think it lasted 2 hours. Now, this morning, I shall try not to do quite that to you, but we are going into a complex and subtle subject. But it's one which is well worth going into. It does lead us into deep water. But as order members, that's where we want to be, isn't it? We want to be really going into the depth and profundity of things. And talking to people over this weekend who've been studying one or other of those articles that I wrote recently, they've been telling me that quite often they started off thinking, well, I don't have any particular concerns or issues around rebirth, and I'm not particularly looking forward to studying it. But then when they did, they found that it opened up quite a lot for them, because it does take you into deep existential waters about what happens after death. And how do I act in terms of what I think happens after death? What do I fear may happen after death? What do I want to happen after death? So we're really going into quite challenging territory in some ways. Now, many years later, in 2008, Sangharakshita went back to the issue of karma and rebirth. He gave a talk in Sheffield entitled Dreams and Rebirth. And in that, he said that he was reasonably well persuaded, and he always chooses his words very carefully, as we know, of rebirth. And he gave various reasons for this. One was that he'd always felt, from the first time that he came in contact with the Dharma, an overwhelming desire to practice it, despite being born in unpropitious circumstances, which may just mean tooting, I'm not quite sure. Being born in unpropitious circumstances. So there was nothing in his environment, in his upbringing, which explained that tremendous response, that deep heart response that he had to the Dharma, and that deep drive to practice it that emerged out of the young Sangharakshita. And then secondly, he said that he'd had certain non-ordinary dreams, which seemed to be connected with a previous life. And then also he took into account the testimony of people who had collected stories of young children who started talking about previous lives. There are people like Francis Story who collected a lot of these accounts, and more recently Dr. Ian Stevenson. And then also, Sangharakshita talked about his friendships with Lama Govinda and Dado Rinpoche, both people who he knew to be utterly sincere and who he could really trust in what they said, and they both claimed to remember past lives. I've met in my life various people who I had no real reason to doubt, who gave me accounts of their memories of past lives too. A few years ago, I met a young Tibetan who was about 16 years old, And he told me that when he was four, he said to his parents, "I'm not going to be here much longer. Quite soon now, the people will come from my monastery and they'll come and get me. And I used to have a beard, you know." So a few months later, sure enough, the search party turned up from one of the local monasteries, and this young Tibetan, this four-year-old, was recognized as the Tulku, the supposed rebirth of a very well-known lama called Dzong Rinpoche. So, and the previous Dzong Rinpoche was very unusual for a Tibetan. He had a sort of very wispy, kind of goatee beard. So there are those sorts of rather strange things, which are difficult to explain. Not impossible, they're not totally convincing evidence, but they're difficult to explain there. They certainly are made sense of if there is rebirth. So Sankaracharya gave these various reasons, and then he ended the talk by encouraging us to reflect on the question of rebirth. And I did quite a bit of that during my three-year retreat in my wooden circus wagon in France. And part of the outcome of that is these two articles. Now, there's a difference between being agnostic about rebirth and denying it, between deciding that there really is no such thing. Yeah, you've thought it through, and that's the conclusion that you've come to. And being agnostic seems to me an entirely understandable position. Most of us have no memory of past lives, nor do we have any deep meditative experience which might show us that awareness must continue after death. So, yeah, we don't know. On one side, we have a very common sort of position these days, a sort of materialist, nihilist position. When those brain chemicals stop doing the job, then awareness comes to an end. There's all that being argued all around us. And on the other side, as Buddhists, we have the testimony of the Buddha and so many other realized people down through the last 2,500 years in India and in Tibet, and also in the Far East too. Pure Land Buddhism clearly is a big element of Far Eastern Buddhism, which believes in rebirth. So in his Sheffield talk, it seems to me, Sankaracharya was gently encouraging us to at least keep an open mind, to leave open the possibility of rebirth, to maintain at least an agnostic position rather than one of denial. So in this talk, I want to look at what happens if you get to the point where you really say, well, no, I've thought it through, there's no rebirth. Death is the end. And, if that's sincerely where you get to, well, that's where you get to. You have to stand there. You can't stand anywhere else. But it does have consequences. It's not a standalone issue. It's not just something where you can think, well, do I believe in rebirth or not? And yes, I've decided there's no such thing. It has consequences for the whole of the rest of the Dharma. The Dharma is very interlinked. So in this talk, I want to do three things. Firstly, I want to briefly clarify what we mean by rebirth, what I understand to be the Buddhist view of what happens to us after death. Secondly, I want to look at a few classic Buddhist texts that some people use to suggest that the Buddha didn't teach rebirth, or if he did, he only did it as a skillful means. And thirdly, I want to examine some of these consequences that there are if you decide that there's no rebirth in terms of your Dharma practice and your Dharma view. I'm not going to go into theoretical arguments against materialism and nihilism. I'm really not qualified. I'm not a philosopher. I'm not a scientist. I leave that to other people. But, for instance, in this month's chapter, Riju Mati points out that materialism, at its most basic level, is a metaphysical view. The assertion that nothing exists apart from matter isn't something that you can prove empirically. It requires a leap of faith and imagination to hold that belief. And that's a fact that many people in our society tend to overlook. Also in this chapter, Advaita has a challenge. He's throwing down the gauntlet to anyone who thinks that there's some scientific proof that consciousness depends completely on the brain. So I hope anyone who feels that they can prove that will take him up in Shabda, and I wish you luck with it. So, but I'm not going there. I'm not looking into arguments for or against materialism. I just want to argue that believing that death is the end isn't the Buddhist position. And then if you do decide that death is the end, that has a lot of consequences for your overall understanding of the Dharma and your practice of it. Okay, so let's start just by looking a little bit at what I understand to be the Buddhist position about what happens after death. So, Buddhism teaches rebirth in the context of the fundamental view of dependent arising. Conditionality is the basis, we can say, of the Dharma. And by rebirth, I mean a further arising of awareness after death, giving rise to a further arising of the skandhas. However, to use the traditional phrase, the being who is reborn, single inverted commas, is neither the same as nor different from the being of the previous life. If they were essentially the same, then there would be a continuing self. There would be a self, and the doctrine of anatta would not be true. If they were completely different, then you couldn't identify, yes, these five skandhas in this life have risen in dependence upon those five skandhas in that previous life. So thinking in terms of complete continuity or discontinuity doesn't do justice to how things are. And the same holds true in this life, if we think about it. Maybe it's simplest to see right here and now. Supposing we think back to when you were two. Maybe there's a photo of you when you were two. Now, clearly, you're not the same as when you were two. If you are the same as when you were two, then I should be handing out teddy bears and building bricks rather than trying to give you a talk on the Dharma. If you're completely different, then you can't look back at that photo of that two-year-old and say, that was me. So there's been a dependent arising, in dependence upon you when you were two, arises you sitting here now. So the same process happens, but with a more radical break, if you like, at death. And in the case of a Buddha, there's a cessation of all clinging to the five skandhas. So the fuel that drives enforced rebirth stops, and there arises the experience of timeless awareness, of jnana. So a Buddha has been liberated from being reckoned in terms of the five skandhas. So, fundamentally, I believe we can sum up the Buddhist position by saying that awareness continues to arise after death, although that awareness isn't ever I or me or mine. There's further experience, but no self, no experiencer. There's no one standing sort of in the middle of experience or behind the experience who has the experience. And one more really important facet of this is that we're heirs to our previous volitions. This is a term that's used in the Anguttara Nikaya. We're heirs, dayada. Yeah? What we do now leaves a legacy for the person that we're to become, so to speak. And so everything that I've done since I was two, all those volitional actions, for better and worse, although they've affected other people, yeah, fundamentally affect this stream of consciousness in a way that they don't affect any other stream of consciousness. And that's the same for each of you too. Yeah. So there's a certain way in which we can talk about, you know, a person and a stream of consciousness, which, although it's inadequate and difficult, does mean something. We are the inheritors of our karma. However, all this is very subtle and difficult. And inevitably, if you're a normal person and you just have a self-view, you feel, well, here I am, I exist, then when you come to look at the whole issue of rebirth, you have to see it in terms of, well, what happens at death? Do I continue to exist or do I cease to exist? Which is completely off track from a Buddhist point of view. There is no self. There is just dependent arising. So the Dharma is a middle way between eternalism, that there's some self, person, soul that continues through experience in this and future lifetimes, and nihilism, which, to use the traditional formulation, says that both fools and the wise are cut off at death. They cease to exist. And that latter position is very common today, as we know, in our society and in many parts of the world. And at the time of the Buddha, it was associated, it seems, with a teacher called Ajita. Ajita Kesakambalin, Ajita of the hair shawl, the hair blanket, the hair garment. And he taught this doctrine that both fools and the wise are cut off at death. That awareness is completely dependent on the body and ceases at death. And the Buddha explicitly rejected this doctrine. And as we'll see later, some of the Buddha's disciples also in the Majjhima Nikaya talk about this, and talk about it as negating the holy life. So this idea that you're cut off at death, that there's nothing after death at all, is called Ucheda Ditti or Ucheda Vada. So having just outlined what it is that I understand by rebirth, let's look at some suttas that are sometimes cited as evidence that the Buddha didn't really teach or believe in rebirth. So one of these is in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's called the Mahatanha Sankhaya Sutta. And in it, there's a monk called Sati, who is rebuked, really taken to task by the Buddha, really given a very hard time by the Buddha, for maintaining that it is this same consciousness that runs and wanders through the round of rebirths, not another. So the Buddha's saying that consciousness wandering through the round of rebirths, not another, is wrong. So is the Buddha saying that consciousness ceases? But no, I don't think so. It's the Buddha rebukes Sati for saying it's this same consciousness. So it's clear that Sati's wrong view is to think of there being an unchanging consciousness, that passes from life to life. The Buddha points out that right now, if you have experiences one after the other through the different senses, consciousness is arising dependently in each experience. So you see something, you hear something. It's not that there is a consciousness which goes to the window of the eyes and then to the window of the ears. There isn't a consciousness, an entity consciousness, that is operating like that. But in each moment, consciousness is arising in dependence upon a visual stimulus and then an auditory stimulus and so on. That's the Buddha's argument. So he's arguing that there's no entity consciousness that continues moment to moment in this life and that goes on from life to life. But that's very different from stating that there's no rebirth through dependent arising. And it's striking that the Buddha only takes Sati to task for imagining an unchanging consciousness that goes through the round of rebirths. He doesn't rebuke him for talking in terms of rebirth in the first place, which would be a much simpler thing to do. And in fact, in the same sutta, we find the Buddha outlining four kinds of nutriment for the maintenance of beings that have already come to be and for the support of those seeking a new existence. So in the same sutta, which supposedly is meant to be arguing that consciousness ceases at death, the Buddha himself teaches rebirth. Then there are those suttas where the Buddha is asked about what happens to him after death, and he refuses to answer. He refuses to answer people like Malunkyaputta and Vajragotta. And again, it seems to me that the Buddha refuses to agree to the various suggestions that are made to him, that a Tathagata exists, or doesn't, or both, or neither, after death. Because what else can he do when all these categories are based on a mistake? They're based on reification. They're based on an idea of a self that will either exist or not exist. They're based on wrong views of existence and non-existence. So any answer that he gives is starting from a false premise. However, although he doesn't answer the question directly, let's see what he does say to Vajragotta. He doesn't say that nothing can be said about what happens after death. He asserts that being liberated from reckoning in terms of the five skandhas, the Buddha is deep, boundless, hard to fathom, like the sea. Now that isn't any kind of definition, because there's no one to define and nothing for them to be defined by, because the Buddha has let go of clinging to all reference points whatsoever. But still, as a statement about enlightened beings after death, it conveys a tremendous amount. Deep, boundless, like the sea. Whereas, if at death, both fools and the wise, like the Buddha, are cut off, it would have been quite easy for the Buddha just to say that. There's another sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya called the Nalakapana Sutta. And in this one, the Buddha is with some of his disciples, and he starts off by checking out they really have faith in him. And they all assure him that they do. And then he says to them, "Now, sometimes I say what has happened to my advanced disciples. I say that such and such a bhikkhu has attained arhantship. Or I say that such and such a bhikkhuni has attained this level, or a layperson has attained that level. Now, why do I do this? Why do I say that someone is never going to be reborn on this level of experience again? And the reason that he gives is that it's because it inspires others of his disciples to attain the same thing. Now, there are two ways you can take that. One possibility is that you can take it as a conspiratorial Buddha, confiding to some trusty monks who he's really checked out, that actually he doesn't really believe in rebirth, but he just says this stuff to encourage some of his disciples who are not got very far yet, to go much further. It's just all a skillful means. However, there's a much simpler way to read the sutta. The Buddha is just saying that, yes, I can see these disciples of mine attaining these states, really becoming arhats, really becoming liberated, gaining stream entry, and so on. I can see that. Now, I don't do that for the purpose of flattering those people, if I mention it. I don't do it for the purpose of gaining honour or renown. I don't do it to show off for myself that I have these extraordinary powers. He says, I don't do it in order to scheme to deceive people, which actually he would be doing. He was just saying, oh yes, so-and-so has attained stream entry and so-and-so has been completely liberated from the cycle of rebirth, when the Buddha knows full well that he doesn't believe in rebirth. That would just be deception. So it seems to me we can take the Buddha quite simply and literally as saying, the only reason why I do this isn't to show off, isn't to flatter anyone, it's just because I see these people attaining these states and I talk about it to help, to encourage, to inspire other people to do the same thing. It's that simple. And if there's any doubt about any of these passages, they're all from the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length sayings, then we can look at other passages in the Majjhima Nikaya, which are a lot simpler, a lot more straightforward. There's a sutta called the Apanaka Sutta, which Apanaka means something like incontrovertible, or it could even be rendered as unambiguous. The unambiguous teaching. And in this sutta, the Buddha says, since there actually is another world, since there actually is more experience after death, one who holds the view there is no other world has wrong view. Since there actually is another world, one who holds the view there is another world has right view. And the Buddha goes on to outline a whole wrong eightfold path and a whole noble eightfold path based on those wrong and right views. It's quite clear. And he also says that the person who believes that there's just this life loses out on two counts. Firstly, he's censured by the wise in this life. At least if you're around the Buddha, you get told off if you hold that there's just this life. But secondly, because of not having gathered skillful karma in this life, they suffer after death. So if you think, oh well, there's only this life, I don't have to concern myself with anything beyond it, you may not practice the Dharma in the same way, according to the Buddha, and because of that, you then haven't made provision for what happens after death. If you don't believe that there is such a thing, you don't make provision for it, or you may not. And then there's also a sutta called the Sandaka Sutta, in which Ananda says that this belief that fools and the wise are both cut off at death is a denial of the Dharma life. Again, extremely clear, and we'll see a little bit more what that means a little bit further on. So now I want to look at some of the consequences of denying that there's anything after death. As I said, it's not just a sort of standalone thing. It has consequences for how you see the Dharma, how you see the Buddha's life, how you see karma, how you see your own practice. So briefly, let's look at some of the aspects of the Buddha's life. According to some of the classic accounts in the Pali Canon, the Buddha's awakening happened, in a sense, in three stages. It talks about three watches. And so there he is, seated under the Bodhi tree. And in the first watch of the night, he remembers in detail, according to these texts, many of his previous lives. And he describes this as his first true knowledge that he attained. In the second watch of the night, with supernormal vision based on deep dhyana, he sees how other beings arise and pass away according to their karma. And that's his second true knowledge. And then thirdly, on the basis of those two, he overcomes the ashavas, attains liberation, and knows that birth is destroyed. And this is his third true knowledge. So if death is the end, if there is no rebirth, then his first true knowledge was deluded, remembering past his own past lives. His second true knowledge was deluded, seeing others arising and passing away. And actually, you think, well, one out of three is not terrible, but it's not a disaster. But his third true knowledge, his liberation, he puts in terms of knowing that birth is destroyed. But that's senseless if there's only one life. You know, once you're born, well, that's it. So practicing in order for birth to be destroyed and thinking that that's what you've done when you attain liberation, if there is no future birth, is nonsense. So I'm afraid the Buddha actually only scored 0 out of 3 for his true knowledges. And then we go on to Sarnath and the Buddha's first teaching to his 5 old comrades in asceticism, where he first proclaims the Dharma. And as he's striving to convince them of his awakening, he repeatedly says, "The deathless has been attained. The deathless has been attained." But if there's nothing beyond death, then he was wrong about that too. Just as he was wrong about maybe all three of his true knowledges. Because the deathless isn't just, well, it's interesting the term deathless, it isn't just the timeless. It's not just talking about timeless experience, it's talking about the deathless. Let's suppose for a moment that the materialists are right and that consciousness is an epiphenomenon of matter. Yeah. I can still have a timeless experience in this life. And while it's happening, it's completely fulfilling. Yeah. It's not for any purpose beyond itself. It's not for the future. It's complete, satisfying in itself. But still, that if consciousness is completely dependent upon the brain, then what happens if I have a heart attack and die in the middle of my timeless experience? It comes to an end. So, nirvana is a totally liberated state of consciousness. If consciousness is dependent on the physical body, then funnily enough, my timeless awareness comes to an end because the necessary conditions for it have disappeared. So if materialism is correct, then nirvana is not unconditioned, but conditioned. And this issue of the deathless is central to traditional Buddhism. If we look at the Arya Pariyatana Sutta, the Sutta of the Noble Quest, it's clear that the Buddha's quest for awakening came from a desire to go beyond death. In fact, to go beyond death and rebirth and re-death and rebirth and re-death. In the Survey of Buddhism, Sangharakshita says that in the West we're concerned with the problem of death. In the East, they're concerned with that endless round. Rebirth, death, on and on and on. And it seems very clear that in the way he describes his awakening, that he feels that he's solved that problem, and therefore he's found the deathless. But if death is the end of the line, then the awakening, the freedom that the Buddha thought he'd achieved, in that sense, is a delusion. And if you deny rebirth, then not only are the Buddha's awakening and his first teaching at Sarnath compromised, so too is his parinirvana. From within the traditional Buddhist view, parinirvana is the final achievement of a Buddha. There he is, he's a liberated consciousness in this life. He's deep, boundless, profound. But still, that consciousness is linked to these five skandhas. But at death, those last potential causes of suffering are let go of, and there's just complete freedom, boundless freedom. But if death is the end, brain awareness stops, and everything stops. There's no freedom, no awareness, no nothing. And so the whole existential significance of that experience of parinirvana changes. It just becomes somebody dying very nobly. Fine example of how to die. But it's not that complete awakening. It's not that complete liberation of a Buddha at all. And in the Abhidhamma, nirvana is talked of in as being with remainder and without remainder. With remainder is liberation in this life, complete letting go of all reference points, complete freedom, and then liberation without nirvana, without remainder, is when even the five skandhas are gone. So the Buddha's awakening has a different significance, his teaching has a different significance, his dying has a different significance. We're just in a completely different world if there's nothing after death at all. More than that, in a way even more serious than that, the whole law of karma is compromised. Some actions don't have consequences if death is the end. If you believe death is the end, then to remain a Buddhist, you have to argue that at least karma holds true for the individual in this life. If you go further and deny that individuals are subject to karma at all, then you don't have a Dharma refuge. If there's really no karma and rebirth, if there's really no karma actions having consequences, then, as I said in my article, you have to go and sit over there with the Jita of the hair blanket and his followers. One of the important aspects of karma, according to the Abhidharma tradition, is death-proximate karma. Yes, that the moment of death, the last thought moment, is important because independence from that, that conditions the first moment of after death, whether that's a new life or an experience in the Bardo. But if death is the end, then that death proximate karma has no vipaka, it has no result. Nothing. It stops. Well, you know, that's perhaps not so serious. But then, as I argued in my first article, what happens if we go back a few hours? Let's suppose that at breakfast I managed to have accidentally, when I thought I was just making myself a nice cup of something, make myself a cup of something extremely poisonous. And I'm beginning now to feel the effects, and I feel like I might have an hour to live. I've got a choice about how I spend my hour. I can spend it talking to you about the Dharma. I can go and knock on Sangharakshita's door and thank him for everything he's given me over the last 40 years. I can go to the shrine room and do my best to sit in samadhi. That's one way in which I could spend that time. Or alternatively, I could get enraged, resentful with the fact that I've managed to poison myself and cut myself off in my almost prime, and feel like, well, you know, if I'm not going to be here anymore, I think I'll take a few of you down with me and go and find some way of poisoning the water supply at Adishtana. Now, one has to feel that those really weighty karmas ought to have really serious consequences. But if death is the end, in an hour from now, when I keel over, what is the difference? The only difference is that I've spent my hour in somewhat differing mental states. And that doesn't somehow feel adequate. It doesn't do justice to those weighty karmas. So if karma doesn't work for my last hour in this scenario, what about 2 hours? What about 2 days? What about 2 months? The whole thing starts to come apart. It starts to unravel. If there's more experience after death, then it's possible for karmas to have consequences, to ripen in those. So you can still maintain a sense of a universe which has an ethical component to it. But if there's just this life, it becomes very difficult to do, very difficult to see how all these karmas can ripen in this life. So let's look at something else related to this. If we look at the Four Noble Truths from the point of view of someone who believes in rebirth, then suffering, First Noble Truth, will continue as long as there is clinging, Second Noble Truth, which will be for as long as we haven't arrived at the cessation of suffering, thirdly, by completing the Eightfold Path. So this makes following the Eightfold Path worth doing under all circumstances, because although it may be difficult to do at times, the alternative is potentially endless suffering. The suffering, the three levels of dukkha, will continue and continue. But let's suppose that death is the end. Let's suppose that death is it. Then the equation looks very different. There's the suffering of this life, still caused by craving. But in this scenario, the cessation of suffering isn't any longer just dependent on following the Eightfold Path. If we want to, we can practice the Dharma. We can try to end our suffering before death. But if we don't, then it's bound to happen anyway when we die, when all experience ceases. You can argue that following the Eightfold Path is still a good thing to do anyway, as it's beneficial for you and for others in this life. And I certainly would argue that. However, you may feel that the effort involved isn't worth it, particularly maybe as you get older. Do you want to put yourself to the trouble of getting up early in the morning to meditate? Or working on your deeply embedded negative tendencies, when in a few years' time, or possibly tomorrow, we don't know, all your suffering will come to an end anyway? Maybe you do, or maybe not. This is an argument that Ananda uses to a wanderer called Sundaka. Yeah. He says that belief in Uccedavada negates the living of the holy life, because a sensible person looks at these people who practice renunciation, who leave home, leave behind all their family and friends, go off, you know, have to beg their food, live outside most of the year. You know, why put yourself through all that suffering when you can stay at home in comfortable conditions? Because at the end of life, which may be quite soon, you both arrive at the same point. It's made no difference. You're both equally finished. So, yeah, he says that belief in annihilationism negates the living of the Dharma life. Finally, if that's true, karma doesn't work, because whether you live your whole life wisely or foolishly, creating karma based on wisdom or foolishness at death, all that makes no difference. It's all cancelled out. The wise and the foolish are both reset to zero, so to speak. Okay, so karma doesn't seem to be standing up very well if death is really the end. But there are further consequences to all this. There are consequences for us in terms of how we see our existential project as order members. It's quite interesting, isn't it? Within the order, it seems like we have quite a spread. We have some people who are quite convinced that there is rebirth. A lot of us don't really know, but it's sort of open to the possibility. There are some people I know who seem to be definitely arriving at the conclusion that there's, you know, death is the end. And if we're seeing things in those terms, we're in a very different world. Yeah? We're in a very different world view. Yes, we can both practice the Dharma. Yes, we can both work on our minds, whether we believe in rebirth or we don't. Yes, we can both be of great help to the world while we're around. But our timescale and our perspective is very, very different. And particularly when we start thinking about death, we are in very different worlds. If death is the end, well, okay, that needs to be, we need to prepare for the fact that, you know, we're coming to an end, and you know, there's a psychological work to be done there in coming to terms with complete non-existence. But if you believe that there's further experience, and then your Dharma practice partly becomes a question of preparing for that. And I don't quite know how. I think mainly out of meditation. Over the years, I seem to have acquired a belief that there is rebirth. And part of my practice involves preparing for death. Not to prepare psychologically for my non-existence, but to set up the conditions for what feels like a tremendous opportunity. And my Dharma practice is partly about setting up the conditions so that, ideally, I find the Dharma again, I find the Sangha again, there's continued practice. So, yes, it just puts us in very different worlds as order members. And in particular, the bodhisattva ideal is really diminished if we believe that death is the end. I mean, it's still a very wonderful thing for any being to do anything for any other being positively is a wonderful thing. and to devote your life to an altruistic aim, an altruistic project, is very wonderful. But still, if you feel that this is the only life you've got, it's very different from the traditional view of the Bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva's deep commitment, expressed in traditionally as a vow, is said to transcend death. It's said to be something which continues life after life. So there's a big difference between feeling, yes, I'll do what I can while I'm here for these beings in this world, and a sense that something deep within you is aligning itself with the Dharma so as to continue being at the service of the Dharma and at the service of living beings, life after life after life, whatever that means. And yes, it's mysterious, but a sense that just, yeah, for as long as the existence of time and so on, yeah, we should be, you know, devoted to the world's sorrows. It's a very different sense to it, very different project. And even going for refuge looks a bit different too, if there's nothing after death. Sankarakshita talks about how he was often asked about this issue of karma and rebirth in the early days of the movement. People were very interested in it. That's probably why there was that two-hour talk. So he would say that, fair enough, if you don't believe in rebirth, you can still practice the Dharma. But Sankarakshita sees going for refuge in terms of commitment, committing yourself to do something. So if we see it like that, then you're committing yourself to becoming a Buddha. That's what you're aiming to do, you know, using the Dharma with all the assistance of the Sangha. If you just have this life, then you've really got to get on with it. Yeah, you really have to make a tremendous effort to do what you've committed yourself to doing. And in his talk in Sheffield, Sankarakshita was saying, well, and that may well put tremendous strain on you. It's almost like the only way in which you can really do that is by making a really forced effort to try to will yourself. And he didn't feel that was healthy. That's not balanced effort. But if you're in this position where you've committed yourself to doing something which is extremely difficult to do, yeah, either you have to make that tremendous forced effort, or you have to decide, okay, well, probably I won't manage to do it. No, I've just got a sensible, steady pace, relaxed, but very full practice. But then you're in that uncomfortable position where you've committed yourself to doing something, knowing full well that you're probably not going to do it. And that's not a very easy position to be in. So, all these are consequences of denying that there's rebirth. It just puts you in a very different world, and a very different world of practice even. And it seems to me that in that talk in 2008, Sankarakshita was encouraging us to at least leave the door open to the possibility of rebirth. So I've talked quite a lot about difficulties of rebirth, the differences between the world that you're in, the world of the Dharma that you're in, if you are open to rebirth and if you deny it. Maybe it's worth just stressing what we still have in common, what we can all agree on as Buddhists. Firstly, we can agree that whether or not there's rebirth, ethical action and ethical practice is always worthwhile in the immediate term. And we can also accept that there is no one who dies. We are really not in this position of this is me here, I've always been here, will I be here after death or not? So we've seen that if there's nothing after death, then the Buddha's awakening scored 0 out of 3 in terms of true knowledges, that karma seems to be severely compromised because even weighty karmas don't seem to have any consequences in accordance with what you'd expect. We've seen that the Bodhisattva ideal is greatly diminished. And we've looked at some suttas where it seems unclear, you know, what the Buddha is saying, but there always seems to be a fairly straightforward argument. And we've also looked at 1 or 2 suttas where it's extremely clear what the Buddha is saying. So I hope that we'll continue to discuss this topic within the order. I think it's a very important one to get clear about because, as I say, it takes us right into the heart of our existential situation. It takes us right into, you know, the whole issue of death and how we see it, how we live on the basis of that. So it's a very important, I'm really grateful to people who contribute to this discussion to help, well, certainly to help me clarify my mind about these things. And if you are still not quite sure where you stand, I hope that, as well as clarifying and thinking things through, if possible, you will leave open at least a chink of light. You know, if it feels like, oh, you know, all those scientists are, you know, doing all those experiments and they're not finding any kind of consciousness anywhere, just maybe, you know, leave a chink of light open to the fact that the Buddha and all those deep meditators and practitioners over the last 2,500 years may just have seen something that you can't measure on an instrument. They may just have seen something that has a deep truth to it. Because if you leave open the possibility that there's more to life than death, then you give the great mystery of existence its full weight, and the Buddha and his awakening its full significance. You see that the Buddha is someone who in life and death is deep, boundless, hard to fathom, like the sea. For me, Buddhism is a profoundly optimistic teaching in which life is revealed as holding potentials far more extraordinary and amazing than we can ever imagine. During my 3-year retreat, just having the opportunity to meditate as deeply as I could, over that time I just had this sense of horizons opening. In my sense of what life was, what the mind was, what consciousness was, expanding. And looking at the people who I've been fortunate to meet in this life, who I feel are much further down the path than I am, I feel that I've had a very similar feeling from them, but far more so, that they were on a journey where tremendous vistas were opening up. Tremendous possibilities, sense of widening horizons. So, yes, in thinking about rebirth, we can at least leave open a chink of light, a possibility that life and the mind may be far more amazing, far more wonderful than is dreamt of in materialist philosophy. Could leave open the possibility that as living beings, we all have an extraordinary potential we can all become awakened beings. And that awakening doesn't come to an end when the body dies. We can leave open the possibility that in this life and beyond, we can be deep, boundless, hard to fathom, like the sea.